Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that introduces WFIU listeners to interesting people from Indiana, the United States, and the world. I'm Owen Johnson. On this occasion, we welcome Stephen Flynn, one of the country's top experts on what we have come to know as homeland security. In 2007, he published a challenging book, The Edge of Disaster, Rebuilding a Resilient Nation. Steve, welcome to Profiles.
I'm delighted to be with you.
You entered the U.S. Coast Guard Academy in 1978. After the Vietnam War, military service wasn't very popular among young people. What led you in that direction?
I recall it well. In fact, we used to have to wear uniforms if we went out on liberty, as we call it, basically when we left the grounds. And it was a time where people literally threw things at you. We're still in that post-Vietnam War, not quite comfortable with things military time mindset. I went in because actually my father had enlisted in the Coast Guard as a young person. I was captivated by the Bark Eagle, which is a tall ship, which is the Coast Guard Academy's training ship for cadets, and the search and rescue mission of the Coast Guard, as well as its missions that were involved with fisheries and so forth. So I was seduced more to the service and in the Coast Guard around its non-military missions. Very quickly, though, found out when I got there that it was very much a military place.
You've had several tours of duty at sea, two as commander. For someone now so concerned with public policy and ideas, how do you look back on that service at sea?
Well, it was the peak of my life, I think, in lots of ways. My second assignment was command of a patrol boat. I was just 23 years old, had a crew of 10, and I basically did hardcore search and rescue off of the coast of the Outer Banks of North Carolina, which is an infamous piece of coastline we call the Graveyard of the Atlantic. It's where the continental shelf comes closest to the shore of the U.S., and when the seas kick up, it can be really messy for mariners who are caught there. And so when they get in trouble, I went out and helped them. I also, though, was located in Norfolk, Virginia, so the heart of this Navy base, the largest Navy base in the world, was all around me. And so I got that sort of piece of the equation that was certainly fit into the national security picture I found myself moving in all along the way. I think one of the core things I came from that very much animates my work now, and my focus is on this issue of resilience and the need for America to become a more resilient society, was out of the experience that what we did in the Coast Guard, we had an unofficial model, which was you have to go out, but you don't have to come back. That is, you basically had to embrace the risk in the effort of going help perfect strangers in order to rescue them and bring them back home. And that sounds like a pretty nutty idea for most people, and it's certainly one where I had to confront a lot of adversity. I found it truly inspiring in lots of ways. It certainly was empowering. When you basically confront adversity head on, in this case what Mother Nature threw at us, you really find out what you're made of, and you also find out what you really value. And that process, I think, is something that we need as a society to increasingly go back to. You know, I really make the case that every generation of Americans has confronted some form of adversity. Certainly the first settlers didn't do this, didn't land in Virginia or land in Massachusetts because they thought it was going to be easier for themselves. They didn't march across the frontier to the Pacific Ocean because they thought it was going to be easier. But what they did in the process of confronting adversity is they came away with a great sense of confidence and optimism. And that's something I think we've lost because increasingly we view adversity as something that basically is somebody's fault or that shouldn't have happened. And what I learned most in my patrol boat days was people can be in the wrong place at the wrong time, no matter how skilled they are as a sailor, but can lose because Mother Nature basically puts you in an impossible position. And so there's some things we can't always prevent, and there's some things that we can't always control, but there are ways in which we can deal with that reality that are empowering and not about being pessimistic or paranoid, but are empowering.
If you think back, I suppose, on some of our recent presidents, both George Bush Sr. and John Kennedy had experiences at war that where they had to overcome adversity.
Yeah, I think that's very much so. And I think, frankly, it's been a problem with our present president, as I think he made it to age 40 without ever having to confront any sense of adversity. It's very difficult to develop empathy when you really haven't had to face things where that are terrifying on their face, but where you work your way through it. So certainly, you know, the opportunity of service gives you that chance. But obviously, there's lots of walks of life where you can confront real challenges. And the key is how we deal with that. It's not to deal with it as woe is me and it's somebody's fault. I think what we really do well as human beings is when we accept those realities and find ways to grow from it and ideally do things that ideally mitigate that risk and consequences for somebody else.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you began to get interested in research and public policy at Norfolk. What was it that really pulled you in that direction?
Well, the issue that I work now was in part played out there, which is the concern that basically our national security apparatus is really not coming to grips with kind of the challenges, the nature of the challenges that confront us. Played out actually in real time in 1985. I was commanding the patrol boat. I got a call early on a Sunday to basically report to the Navy base there for a secret briefing. And the briefing that I was dragged to was one that was about a what was thought to be a potential, it was iffy intelligence, but a potential terrorist attack that might be directed against a incoming Navy ship that had been involved in the Gulf of Sidra, Libya event that happened back in 1985. And basically, these naval officers turned to the Coast Guard commander, who was the other Coast Guard officer there, and said, what are you going to do to protect a Navy ship? And he said, that's why I have this Lieutenant J.G. here. Steve commands a patrol boat, and that's his job. And I looked at him just in total disbelief. The Coast Guard at the time had been facing what we called a ammunition moratorium. That meant that we had so few bullets that we couldn't practice with them because we had none to replace them if we need them in the real world. Counterterrorism was not something I was trained on. Search and rescue I was doing pretty good at. I was starting to get okay at counter drugs, was basically going aboard ships and looking for things where the things are might be hidden. But taking on people who were intent on killing people was not a skill set I had. But the Navy basically said, we don't do that job of protecting our forces here in ports. That's a Coast Guard function. And so Coast Guard, you know, what are you going to do to protect us? And the Coast Guard simply didn't have the resources to do this. But I thought what was really drove home for me, though, is, you know, for every nation in the world, national security is usually about two things. First, it's protecting the nation from threats that might be on it. And secondly, if they have any power left over, it's protecting their interests beyond their shores. So every nation but the United States, our national security is only about that second thing. It's about projecting our power beyond our shores and managing interests out there. But the Department of Defense won't even protect itself when it's on our homeland, never mind the rest of the homeland. And so I sort of brought into stark relief the line that we drew throughout the Cold War, which was view national security as something that happens strictly beyond our water's edge. And somebody else's job was to deal with the mess if it should happen here. And yet we are woefully under-resourcing the ability to manage that threat in that environment. And it struck me as just a junior officer at the time that this didn't seem to be very sensible. Maybe I'll find out that somebody really gets this when I get up to a chance to talk to people further on or study the issue. And the more I studied, the more screwed up how I found it was. And sadly, here we are this many years later, it remains a core critique that I have, is that 9/11 didn't change everything. What we essentially did is took the national security apparatus we had designed for the Cold War and put it on steroids as a water's edge out. And we are still groping very ineffectively with the how do we manage these domestic entities who have always been poorly funded and have not worked very well, certainly together, never mind individually, and how do we basically make them work effectively to essentially deal with threats that materialize here in the United States. Really haven't sort of gotten the fact that these threats are transnational in character, that is, they really don't pay attention to borders. And that really at the heart of it is that at the end of the day, this is not something that can be done by professional soldiers or spies or law enforcement. It's really something that's going to require a lot more engagement of civil society at large. And that's something that I think is a lesson entirely unlearned since September 11th.
Now, do you think that the emphasis on the external solution had to do with the fact that the Soviet Union did not try to undertake terrorist threats or something like that, so that in effect the Soviet threat was overseas rather than domestically?
Yeah, I think it was very much a creature of the Cold War, or very much an element of the old war, was the fact that we would contain Soviet power basically on the soil of our allies, in the case of our European NATO allies, and that we confronted in proxies as it played out more in the 70s and 80s, and obviously in Vietnam was viewed as a proxy at the time. But that's how the conflict would be managed. But the big oceans to the east and west and friendly neighbors to the north and south didn't mean that there was a clear and present threat on our soil. The only one that had a homeland dimension to it were missiles that would come across the polar ice cap and would potentially end up, you know, destroying our country in that way. And so we created a command for the Department of Defense to maintain what's called NORAD, the Northern Air Defense System, with our Canadian neighbor, because these missiles would come across Canadian soil. So we cohabitated that in the Cheyenne Mountain Complex, literally buried in the bowels of that mountain, to manage that threat. But beyond that, the Department of Defense didn't engage on things that we would call homeland security. And it still remains the case today where it's really struggling. It has a mission that's actually defined as homeland defense, which is different from homeland security, different in their view. Homeland defense, they define, is when something, an adversary outside the United States conducts an attack on the United States. And they say that's our job. Homeland security is defined as when the attack materializes inside the United States on the United States. And they say that's the job of the Department of Homeland Security. The problem is everything we know, certainly should have learned from September 11th, is the adversary is going to blend in the civil economic space. So he's more likely to be bumped into by non-DOD players. They're not going to fly a Jolly Roger and say, I'm incoming. And so the threat will materialize. The Department of Defense essentially says, well, it's going to be a homeland security problem because we didn't see it. And the reality, of course, is that that line is a very phony line in the kind of threat environment we're in. And yet the divide is a very firm one. The Department of Defense still very much focuses externally and at best of what might get to our borders. It's got aerospace down. But when it comes to anything that actually happens on U.S. soil, that becomes a Department of Homeland Security responsibility. And that's a department that's still very much struggling to get its feet.
Now, your involvement in Homeland Security issues, obviously, it goes well back in your career. You were even with a task force dealing with that subject before September 2001. Given that kind of background, what was your reaction on the morning of September 11th to what had happened?
I had actually arrived in New York that morning on the Metro North commuter train from Connecticut, where I live. I got in the city around 8:35, and I took the subway, which is a short three stops up, to the Council on Foreign Relations, which is located on the Upper East Side, and got into my office about 5 or 9, and my neighbor had the TV on and called me in. And my reaction was very much a, well, here it is. It wasn't a, I'm shocked. And it was followed by a reaction that was more painful and to some extent, I suspect, looking back on it, had definitely a mix of hubris in it, but it was a sense of, I didn't do enough. That as much as I've been involved with this, knowing the threat as I knew it, and now knowing this consequence, that maybe I should have been, you know, working harder at this in some way. And that certainly has animated a lot of my work since, though I'm primarily driven not so much with the sense of we have to do whatever it takes to protect ourselves. You know, I'm a realist about this, just as I learned my patrol. Sometimes things will happen you can't control. But I'm very wary it's not so much of what terrorists can do to us, but what we can do as to ourselves as a society when we're spooked, how we overreact for things that we feel unprepared for. And so a lot of what animates my effort is not trying to find ways to somehow prevent any accident ever happening again, but is to actually react to something else I saw that happened on September 11th that I really found inspiring. And that was watching how New Yorkers responded. I mean, on September 11th, there was virtually no federal government involved. Recall the president was down in Florida at a school. Basically, the entire Washington apparatus went to ground. And meanwhile, New Yorkers had to cope with this calamity. And a little-known story, and it's just an amazing one, and it's one that should really inspire us, is that a lot of the people who left the World Trade Center towers went south to the tip of Manhattan at Battery Park and were stranded there. And the Coast Guard gave a call out in the harbor and said, look, we got a lot of people that need to get off Manhattan. Anything that floats, if you can go out and help. And the largest amount since Dunkirk, the fleet that actually pulled the British Army off when the Nazis rolled in, showed up spontaneously. That is, there were no plan for this. It was everything from tourboats to tugs and barges, and it was the biggest evacuation by water in U.S. history. And it happened without any federal engagement except for that one call from the Coast Guard captain of the port. Americans showed that day that they are resilient. We didn't know immediately the story of United 93, but it's one that very much has animated the recent book that I did. I may go as far as to make this case. Americans took away from September 11th as the dominant narrative that there were bad people out there intent on killing us here. And the president has basically said, I've got to do whatever it takes to make sure that never happens again. I make an argument that the dominant narrative actually should have been what happened in United 93. United 93, of course, was the fourth plane that left Newark a bit later than the other planes. And when it got up in the air, the terrorists were a bit cocky, and they didn't prevent the people from grabbing the phones in the back of the seats. And when they called their friends and loved ones, they found out something that people in the first three planes did not know, that planes were going to be used as missiles that day. And armed with that information, they did something very important. That plane never found its intended target. And the intended target the 9/11 Commission found was almost certainly the Capitol or the White House. There's an irony here. Our government, which we constituted to provide for our common defense, on September 11th was defended itself by one thing alone, an alerted and brave everyday citizens. That's our greatest strength. It's not our second to none military. Having a second to none military is a great asset to have in a dangerous world, but the greatest strength that every great president we've had has called on, from Washington to Lincoln to FDR, to John Kennedy's call to say, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Every great president has reached into that core strength of our civil society and engaged us around the hazards that we confronted. Except this one, that essentially said, go to the mall. We're going to take our national security apparatus. We're going to put it on steroids, essentially. We're going to do a lot of things that you shouldn't ask us about because it's a messy world out there. And while it is a messy world, and we need many of those tools, I think we have lost our way. And what I saw on September 11th with both, of course, the horror of what the threat that I knew well before 9/11, how it can materialize, but also saw the inherent resilience of the American people to deal with that. The people are resilient, I'm convinced. It's our government that's got some problems. And I think our ability basically to get that resilience back is how we're going to manage this threat as we go forward.
But you have acknowledged that it is a major challenge to look at all of the issues concerned and talk about talking particularly about one that you addressed probably a decade ago in the November-December 2000 issue of Foreign Affairs, when you wrote, "The global economy's movement toward more open societies and liberalized economies does not just facilitate the movement of products and workers. It also expedites passage for terrorists, small arms, drugs, illegal immigrants, and disease." That's a lot. That's a big agenda to deal with. Where do you start?
It sure is. Well, you don't start with Homeland Security. Homeland Security has been a very clumsy term in that it basically what we're trying to secure really are public goods that operate in a global landscape and move through transnational networks, that is, networks that pay very little attention to boundaries. So Homeland Security as a focus is a bit like hiring a network security person who basically only says, I'm protecting the computer next to my desk. It's too complicated going out to the rest of them. Anybody would fire such a network security. So problems rarely originate in a domestic jurisdiction or stay isolated in a foreign jurisdiction. They have to be managed in that cross-border context. And so what I was trying to write about back in that piece is that the nature of many of these things we viewed as domestic threats, illegal immigration is a domestic issue, drugs as a domestic issue, other forms of contraband that moves through the system as a domestic issue. Actually, these were tied to global networks with lots of global incentives. And ultimately, though, the controls would have to be managed in that globalized context. So one of the problems I certainly am concerned about, I'm actually somebody at the Council on Foreign Relations who's got the job supposedly of doing Homeland Security. I probably spend about a fifth of my time overseas, though. Most of the problems that I'm wrestling with are tied to both overseas in some ways. But more importantly, there's an alignment of interest that's available if we're willing to talk about it in these terms where we can get the cooperation required to manage these threats. We can't eliminate them. That's, I think, an important lesson we have to take away. We won't have – terrorism is going to be a bit like the flu. You're going to get different strains each season. That's the kind of mindset I'm asking Americans to accept as a reality. And there are catastrophic forms of it that we need to manage, but we can manage with different kinds of tools we're using today largely, the kinds of things that Sam Nunn and Senator Lugar have been advocating about. If the biggest threat is nuclear weapons and nuclear materials being turned into nuclear weapons, why don't we start cleaning some of that stuff up? And it's a heck of a lot more affordable that way. Other pieces of this are clearly if we're worried about things like anthrax, well, actually, we should probably be more worried about things like avian flu, which requires adequate public health to manage. So we don't have to do it just around a counterterrorism mandate. We need to deal with these threats as hazards as they are. Many of them actually that are more frightening and more consequential are things that are going to come to us from acts of God or from nature than they are from acts of man. And so we've really got to be willing to sort of rethink the nature of hazards as recognizing that they're really – this is a part of a global society we're living in that has them. And while we have clearly domestic capacity that needs to be in place to do this, it should be tethered to, at a minimum, our North American neighbors, but ultimately, obviously, to manage it in a broader global landscape.
Do you think some Americans get upset, perhaps, when they appear or they think that, well, we're protecting ourselves against terrorism by these interminable checks at airports, where you take your belt off, your shoes off, you empty your pockets, you take your jacket off, do all of those things. Does that turn Americans off? Because there's so much done, and some of them say, but are they really finding anything? They find a nose ring or a belly button ring.
It turns me off. And I've been somebody who's doing this for a living. But here's what I often say, and this is a challenge when I ask Americans to think about security. I say, what my conviction is after a career of working these issues is smart security is always nuanced and almost always counterintuitive. Tough security is always simple, which makes it bureaucratic and politically attractive and always ineffective. If you build, as the governor of Arizona has said, a 50-foot wall, you'll find a 51-foot ladder to get over the wall. If you basically have things that are fixed, rote, and ritualistic, for our most tenacious adversaries, the ones we really need to be worried about, that becomes a very easy thing to end run. So as you basically put in these very rote, ritualistic enterprise, so they have several downsides. One is they don't provide much in the way of intimidation for an adversary who just figures out how to work around them. But the more deleterious one is the point that you're really raising, is it alienates the very people who are in the civil economic space who have to be a part of the solutions of dealing with these threats and managing our way through the hazards. The story of 9/11 really is a story of, and that's what United 93 highlighted, as I spoke about, is that the thing that really would have stopped the 9/11 scenario are two things. You would have, if we hardened the cockpit door so people couldn't access the cockpit, that means you couldn't turn the plane into a guided missile. And we need to change the behavior of the passengers. And as we've seen other incidents, like the incident with the shoe bomber, Robert Reed, when people saw what he was up to, they jumped him. That solved that problem. And yet, the rest, we've been taking off our shoes ever since. So some of these risks are really something that we have to get out of this notion that either technology or our government is going to protect us, and we can be passive as we go through the system. And while there are certainly some tools that can enable that, the actual intelligence security has to be dynamic and organic for it to work, and ultimately for people not to be alienated by it. So I guess where I was king for the day, I would go right after aviation security and fundamentally revise it in ways, because I think that's the face of security. And most Americans are saying, if that's what it is, I'd rather not have it. And that's a problem, because we do need things that we're calling security. That's where I point to resiliency. Resilience is about basically looking at systems that are critical. And instead of basically making this focus on how do we prevent things at all costs, you're really saying what we're trying to do is protect these critical systems. And we do it in four ways. First, we make them robust enough that they can take a punch. That is, we have foreseeable things like earthquakes that make the ground move, or hurricanes that send the winds up very high, or floodwaters that come up. We can anticipate these, and we design things that are critical to basically withstand that force. In some cases, in networks, we also add redundancy. We basically make sure that, okay, things will fail, but we can throw a switch, then we can sustain the critical system. So you don't need to harden things. You just have a switch. And some of you basically look to recover them quickly. And that is, if they go out and you can fix it real quick, then you don't have to harden them because it can be repaired. But so this one element is this robustness. The second one is called resourcefulness, which is basically the ability to see things are unfolding when they are and get mobilized to respond quickly. And then you recover. And the last one is you review. You learn from what you were saying. And that's a cyclical thing. It becomes a dynamic. When you review, you say, how could I redesign and make sure that we're well prepared for these incidents? And you do this as an ongoing concern. When we get into the security mindset, one is we often see in absolute terms. You're either secure or you're not. And we also end up in this sort of this moats and castles kind of mentality, Jersey barriers, and everybody being checked whether their people pose a threat or not. Don't exercise any human judgment. God forbid we do that. So that kind of mindset, though, is actually antithetical to dealing with the kind of adversary that we're confronting.
You talk about using those four things to use as a kind of checkoff list. Should the average person be thinking about that himself or herself, or should this be something that the government does? And then one thinks, well, the government can tend to be a bureaucracy and perhaps is not very well equipped to do it. In other words, who is going to be the actor in this?
Yeah, the fundamental actor has to be we the people part here. We really have to recognize most of us operating basically being pretty lucky. That is, we've lived through a benign time largely from a nature standpoint. That is, major climate events were actually pretty quiet. For hurricanes, for instance, for those who lived in the East Coast and Gulf Coast, we went through an unusually quiet period between 1970 and 1985. That, unfortunately, was the time we decided to decamp from the center of the country and move out on the coast. So to some extent, we're basically saying we have to deal with reality, which is Mother Nature causes mischief from time to time. And North America is a beautiful continent, but it's one that mischief happens relatively frequently. So we have to deal with that reality. Secondly, that government, particularly the federal level, is not equipped to provide immediate kinds of levels of response. And if it were able to, we almost wouldn't want to live with the thing. So we really do need our own level of self-reliance. The case that I make for self-reliance is really around, first, you know, we need to do it at the individual family level. We need to do it at the business level. And I try to make the case for this is not an act of paranoia or pessimism by trying to be prepared enough that essentially if you lost some modern conveniences, you could camp out in your own home for 3 days comfortably. That's not something that should be about being paranoid. It really is an act of two things that are important. One is a civic good. You know, when things go badly wrong, there's usually people who are really hurt and really in need, and there are a limited amount of first responders. Those people need to be able to focus on the people who are really hurt versus somebody who basically doesn't have enough medicine, so ends up in the emergency room, or people don't have enough water, so they end up trying to queue up for water and all the rest of that kind of madness. So by basically being prepared enough to ride things out, if you have the resources to do so, you're basically contributing in a civic way to not stressing systems that really need to help other people. The second is a great sort of peace of mind that goes with that kind of preparation. And I try to get Americans to think about the realities of modern life. Technology has won us over in lots of ways. They've created this where we literally live in climate-controlled offices where the temperature never moves in our homes, plus or minus a couple of degrees. And so we imagine, therefore, that things will always stay this way. Well, it's an illusion. The fact is things break from time to time and things will go wrong from time to time. And being prepared for these things is very important for your own peace of mind. But it also is, I'm asking Americans to think much like somebody goes off on a camping trip. Now, somebody went off on a camping trip and failed to do things like check the flashlights or get batteries in them or make sure the tent doesn't have holes in it or make sure they let people know where they're going, when they're going to be back and so forth. We'd say the person is absolutely irresponsible. And doing those things, though, people do it not just to be responsible. It actually makes the trip more enjoyable because when you confront the whoops situation, you don't feel incapacitated and powerless because you're prepared to deal with those situations. And so there's a peace of mind knowing you've taken those measures. It also, if something goes wrong, it doesn't destroy the trip. And you don't end up calling on resources that, you know, putting other people in danger potentially help you out when you could have helped yourself. In the same way, we just basically have to accept that modern life is a lot like going on a camping trip. That from time to time, you know, we're going to get bruises and we need to be self-sufficient enough to manage these things for a short period of time. That shouldn't entirely let our government off the hook. Many of the challenges that confront us are things that require the mobilization of resources and the ability on such a large scale that individuals or even small communities can't respond. We saw this in the case of Katrina. I mean, it was simply outrageous for folks to say, well, it was New Orleans' fault that this thing happened. There were lots of blame you could cast around it here. But the fact is there were a lot of very desperate people needed help, and we surely as a nation had the means to help them, and it wasn't mobilized very efficiently or effectively. And that, is, for me, is a national disgrace. We shouldn't rely solely on the center to help us, but when we have tools and it's times of need, that's why we came together as a society. And we need to think about how we manage these truly catastrophic events that require that kind of capability.
Let's take a break here and ask you this difficult question. What musical selection would you like to hear and why?
The Sounds of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel.
Why?
It's one of my favorite songs, and it's one of those songs I can't still quite figure out. So I'll let the listener draw his own conclusions.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone. Streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp. I turn my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stabbed.
That was Sounds of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel, music chosen by our guest on Profiles today, national security expert Stephen Flynn. You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. In your book, America the Vulnerable, How the Government is Failing to Protect Us from Terrorism, which came out in 2004, many people at that time still agreed with the Bush administration, which argued that if the U.S. didn't fight terrorists abroad, they would be fighting them at home. Wrong argument?
It has been a wrong argument on two levels. One is it simply isn't and can never be an either-or proposition. As we knew, certainly by 2004, the al-Qaeda threat and the imitator organizations, the splinter groups that were growing up, were not concentrated just in Afghanistan or the Pakistan border or in Iraq, now that we made that a central front in the war on terror. They were springing up in Europe, as we saw with the attack on the Madrid train system. We also, of course, saw a little later attacks on London. That information was readily available. The reality is that we have to manage this threat within a globalized context, and the notion that somehow we could win the war on terror by taking the battle to the enemy, assume one, we could recognize the enemy and then have the means to actually eliminate it, when everything we know about this adversary is that he occupies a civil economic space, tends to blend into it. We also know our intelligence is not very good. That's why we reorganize and keep reorganizing it. And it won't likely be good for a decade. And so I guess what I had in his face, the logic it struck me of saying in 2004, the only defense is an offense. When offense required good intelligence in order to do, but everybody admitted that our intelligence was awful, that seemed to be a strategy that had a lot of shaky foundation to it. And the minimum argument was you've got to have a contingency plan for if you're not going to pull that off. But by putting all that eggs in that basket, we basically left the what if it actually does happen? We fail to prevent. How do we respond? How do we recover? How do we manage it? We left that off the table. And this is how crazy things were even in 2004. Shortly before the election, the Vice President Cheney came out and said, the number one national security threat to confront the United States will be a weapon of mass destruction going off in a major city. You need to wrap your mind around that concept. Well, literally 2 days before that, I sit down with a very senior chief in the Fire Department of New York to talk about a lesser scenario, which is a scenario involving a dirty bomb. Now, a dirty bomb is essentially a conventional bomb with commercial-grade radioactive material mixed in it. It's not a mushroom cloud. It basically spends a lot of radioactive material around. So it's a cleanup problem and certainly could be a health risk for those who are exposed to it. And the basic first most important remedial step you do to somebody who's exposed to an area of a dirty bomb is you give them a shower. That basically, if you don't inhale the radioactive content, you're not going to basically suffer health consequences. But if you get it on, two things happen. One is a risk that you'll inhale it over time or some form of intake. But more dangerously, you carry it back to your homes or carry it in the hospitals and you contaminate those environments. So what we need to do is give you a shower and give you a change of clothes. So I was asking this senior official in the FDNY, how is New York prepared to deal with the dirty bomb scenario? Can you give people showers? And there was a good news side of the story. He said, yes, we have a plan for that. If a dirty bomb went off in Central Park, we put fire trucks on the side, either side of the Fifth Avenue, and we have people shuck off their clothes and we hose them down. And then we have hospital gowns that they can put on. I said, okay, that's nice to know you have a plan. How would that work in February? Long pause. Well, we really don't have a plan for February. I said, well, you'll kill more people with hypothermia doing that than you would with the nuclear material. And so for me, the disconnect here was if you believed, as I'm sure the vice president did and does, that this is the number one threat, why didn't anybody get on the phone to the city that's most likely to be the target and say, hey, can you guys give people showers? And how can we help? And that follow-through, that failure to think through what that threat should have materialized and what basic measures could we take to mitigate the consequences, save real lives, and allow that society and community to respond and recover quickly, that's been off the map pretty much because of this. We do it over there, so we don't have to do it here. And I don't know any sports event that works well relying solely on offense. And this is a case where I'm actually making a pitch, though. The best defense may actually be a pretty good defense, where our defense is resiliency. And when we're more resilient, we're far less attracted for terrorists to essentially to find value in engaging in these acts on our soil because it's less consequential. and they're not easy to do. And so there is strategic value, there's deterrent value to building resilience. The idea that it's hopeless to imagine that we could protect ourselves is hopeless to even too expensive or too complicated. This is nonsense. This is something that, like every complicated problem, requires you to break it down and work your way through it, but it's one Americans are more than up to the task for handling. And I would push it further. It's disgraceful as a nation to put the responsibility on our young men and women in uniform to continue to make, as they are making, the ultimate sacrifice to protect us, in part because we're so vulnerable they have to do whatever it takes out there to protect us, while we do nothing here at home to make ourselves less vulnerable. The least we can do on the home front is reduce our own exposure that warrants the kind of sacrifice that these folks have been making on our behalf.
Obviously, much of what you propose costs money. You, in fact, yourself have compared the cost of a day or two of war in Iraq with how much is being spent on homeland security. That suggests the money has to come from somewhere. How do you sell that, particularly in a shaky economy, telling people we need to raise taxes? One needs only think of President Bush's famous comment, "Read my lips, no new taxes," and see where that got him. How many politicians are going to vote the kind of money that would be necessary for some of the things you advocate?
It's a tough sell in the environment we're in, but I don't think it's a tough sell to make. The sell is really, one is I would use the example of Dwight Eisenhower. When he was president, of course, he actually thought up through, as a former general as he was, that the Cold War might get hot, and that would have some implications. One is we'd have to mobilize the country quickly. And secondly, if we actually had our cities under threat, we'd have to evacuate them. And with that perspective, he brought us the Interstate Highway System, which is actually called the Interstate Highway and Defense Act. But the notion here was that there was a federal national security rationale for essentially building infrastructure to basically be able to manage this foreseeable threat. And while at the same time we were clearly making commitments beyond our shores, the investment was also being made here. Now, looking back on 50-plus years, we know that we've never had to put the highway system to use for what Dwight Eisenhower advocated, why it was needed in part, but we've derived enormous economic benefits from that investment. Now, we would design it a little differently today, knowing what we know about the environment and so forth here, but the fact is there is a compelling rationale from a national security standpoint for investing in infrastructure to make it more resilient so it's less attractive for our adversaries to hit it, but we get a dual benefit for doing these things. The thing about investing in resilience is virtually all of it is something that we should be doing even though we're no terrorists. You know, what we know, for instance, about is, and we learned this very sadly with Katrina, what destroyed New Orleans was not the hurricane, but was the collapse of the flood control system. And when the winds hit New Orleans, they were barely above Category 1. They weren't Category 3 plus. The system failed. And we know the failure to make the investment in the flood control is what drowned that city and the huge costs associated with it. Basic number out there is that for every dollar you invest in essentially prevention on when it comes to disaster risk, you get $7 in return when the disaster actually happens. So there's an economic argument. And the case I really would make here overall is, you know, Americans are in this bizarre, I would argue, mindset. We look at our infrastructure, which is really a legacy bequeathed to us by the ingenuity, hard work, and investment of our forebears that built everything from the bridges and the highways and the dams and the locks and the rest of it that makes the country work as a modern advanced society, bequeathed to us, and we say we can't afford to maintain it. It's like as somebody who's inherited the grandparents' mansion, we decide we're going to do the upkeep. And people drive by going, nice house. But, of course, the plumbing's falling apart, the wiring's falling apart. This makes no sense from our quality of life. It makes no sense for the investment that's there. And so the mindset has to be we can't afford the cost of our infrastructure. It's really, no, we can't afford not to make the investment in it because it has real costs not making these investments. It has security costs, it has economic costs, it has quality of life costs. And when we invest in this infrastructure, we have a chance to make it greener. We have a chance to re-engineer it so it's more secure and resilient. So that, I think, and by the way, it's jobs that are generated. They're here. You can't outsource them. And they ultimately generate, I think, a compelling economic rationale as well as a strategic rationale. We've lost – it's just horrific when I think about this. You know, when I grew up, certainly my parents' and grandparents' generation, public works were a source of great national pride. And then I look through the world today through the lens of my daughter who's 12 years old. When she was six, the World Trade Center towers came down as a result of an act of terror. When she was eight, the Northeast went dark because of a breakdown of the grid because trees grew too high in wires. When she was 10, New Orleans was drowned by a hurricane. And when she was 12, a bridge collapsed outside of commuters on the way home on a sunny summer evening in Minneapolis. It's just unbelievable that we're allowing this legacy to essentially implode underneath us and not see that as a national calling to address. So I think Americans can respond to it, just as they have responded to these calls before. We got to get out of this mindset that we can't afford it. We're the wealthiest country on the planet. We have $13.5 trillion GDP. We may have to think about some of the defense spending we're making and recalibrate that, but we cannot afford to invest in the things that make our advanced society advance and provide the kind of baseline that we need to stay competitive as a society.
Now, some people would attack you just for what you or for what you just said. We may have to rethink some of the defense spending that, in fact, what you propose in the shifting of funds might leave us vulnerable overseas.
I'm ready for that contest. I'll just offer one up. I had an opportunity to testify before Congress on the ballistic missile defense program. In March of 2008, it turned 25 years, essentially, between the time that President Reagan, in an Oval Office address on television, announced what became known as the Star Wars Initiative. America has spent $120 billion since then developing ballistic missile defense. Actually, we've been spending it doing the research to develop ballistic missile defense. Now, there are only five countries in the world that actually have intercontinental nuclear missiles. They are the United States, the United Kingdom, France, China, and Russia. Al-Qaeda does not have missiles, and Iran will not have an intercontinental missile for as far as we can project out. So you're spending that amount of money on a shield that even if we're constructed would create the incentive for people to say, well, I guess I won't send it on a missile. I'll send it in the belly of a ship. I'll send it on a truck, or I'll send it on a rail car, or I'll bring the pieces here and construct it here in the U.S. It does not stand up from a logic standpoint that investment makes sense, and it certainly doesn't stand up from a fiscal responsibility standpoint. But yet we have Cold War defense programs that still have a momentum of their own. So we have some wiggle room there. And to put that into context, the total amount of money that the Bush administration asked in 2009 for a program called Civilian Corps, an effort to reach out to Americans to train them how to deal with this basically crises and disasters, was $15 million, which is what we spend every hour in the war in Iraq.
You mentioned in one article, I think it was in response to the Minneapolis bridge disaster, that China spends more money on its infrastructure taking care of things than the United States. Are there other countries that we can draw lessons from in this?
I think we surely can. I mean, every country to some extent is struggling with how to manage the broad phenomenon of urbanization, that more and more people have moved into urban areas, obviously growth in population, certainly in the developing world, and the underlying infrastructure, whether it's basic sanitary kind of needs, how to get rid of sewage and so forth, fresh water, moving that around, sustainability of the power grid. These are issues developing countries are struggling with, whether it's India or China or much poorer countries than those two. The problem of Europe and the U.S. is basically how to deal with aging infrastructure, where the infrastructure would probably be designed differently today than when it was designed in the 19th and in many cases the 20th century. And yet you have to maintain it while you're also upgrading it or improving on it here. And so it's a different set of challenges that goes with it. So it's a broad – everybody's in the same sort of pickle of having to figure out how we have infrastructure sustained a continued growing population that wants to be more connected and increasingly wants to be more urban in how it lives. And that requires essentially a lot of engineering, and engineering that basically transcends borders in terms of how these networks work and operate across each other. It suggests to me that actually there's a lot of common ground here for conversations. These aren't purely local, state, or even federal issues. For instance, you know, there was a debate in 2005 over a company called Dubai Ports World investing in a port terminal operation in ports in the U.S. caused a big hoorah. One of the things that came out of it was congressional legislation proposed that all critical infrastructure should be nationally owned by a U.S. company. Well, I made, remember talking with the congressman responsible for this, and I said, of course, then we're going to be buying the power generation in Quebec, and we better pick up the pipelines that come down from British Columbia. And ports are really on-ramps and off-ramps, so we'll have to be buying all these ports overseas as well. And the reality, of course, is that when it comes to our energy infrastructure, our financial infrastructure, telecommunications, these are global networks. And we're going to have to figure out how we make them sustainable in the context of that North American broader global context. The idea we can do this at our borders or purely from a U.S. perspective is just simply not connected with reality.
Which do you think is the bigger threat, the response to domestic issues such as Katrina, such as the bridge collapse, such as gas leaks, or is it the international terrorism threat?
I would argue the more probable, the more consequential threat for everyday Americans will come to us by acts of nature and accidents than they will from acts of man. And that's not to mitigate that there isn't the threat of mass to man. It's really to say just the opposite, that the threats that are more probable and consequential are, in fact, more real than we often have given them to. The biggest risk, I can't come up with any military scenario, any national security scenario, short of the spasmodic release of the remaining nuclear weapons that Russia and the United States has. Like we just suddenly let loose all that we had left, that could get me near the loss of life of a avian flu pandemic outbreak should the flu be able to migrate from human-to-human transmission. Can't get close. And so if that's the reality, the thing that's most likely to kill most of us or disrupt our lives and more, and we talk about disruption, we're basically going to shut things down because of not knowing how to manage that risk. And this is how complicated it gets. Turns out 90% of the plastic gloves that are used in the medical field are made in Malaysia. And hospitals today don't have big inventories because that's expense. So they basically have good things we call supply chains that move things. When they need it, they get it in time. And so where hospitals, major places like Sloan Kettering or major hospitals would have had 2 weeks' supplies before, today they have two or three days' worth of supplies because always gets it when they need it. So one can imagine if we had an avian flu outbreak, likely starts in Southeast Asia. First response is don't let everything come from there. And then one thing we'll catch in that mesh is all the plastic gloves. So how are the hospitals going to work when they have no gloves? What we fail to realize is the extent to which things like that level of detail are bound up in an increasingly globalized economy and network and how our behaviors have changed. And we could incapacitate ourselves by not having adequate systems to address, in this case, something that has nothing to do with terrorism but has a great deal to do with the kind of vulnerability we have, the hazards we have. Where I think there's opportunity here when you take this more all-hazards perspective is all the capacity we need to build from public health and from being able to communicate and help each other around that kind of threat would help you deal with the bioterror threat. And yet we basically have a federal government that says we can only spend money on terrorism because that's national security. Everything else is a state-local problem or a private sector problem. I mean, this is nuts. If what capacity we need to build is around probable consequential things, traditionally managed at the state and local level, well, we want to help states and locals do it better, and that may require resources. And you know, this is a debate that we simply haven't had. This whole, you know, it's a classic issue of federalism. Traditionally, we've managed issues like public emergencies at the state local level, and that's a great place to do it. But what we started doing during the Cold War is to send the bulk of our incomes, tax incomes, off to Washington. And Washington spends the bulk of that on traditional national security. States and locals are now left to manage threats that are more probable and consequential, but we haven't redone the formula. So we have one of two choices, it seems to me. We stop sending so much to Washington and give more to our states and locals so they can develop this capacity, or Washington has to send some back to the state and locals. But what's crazy is essentially have us spend 30%+ of our money to Washington. They spend half the discretionary spending on traditional national security because that's their bailiwick. And we all know that states and locals simply don't have the capacity to deal with emergencies if there are any scale here when they materialize.
Is there any room here for international cooperation? We think of the United Nations as having been a post-World War II organization, very important during the Cold War in resolving conflicts. We think of NATO. Are there international organizations that could facilitate addressing these kinds of issues?
They certainly provide a rationale for that level of engagement, and one could imagine recalibrating the agendas of institutions like the United Nations or even NATO to begin to sort of put things in this context. What I love about the resilience concept is it is to achieve it requires an open and inclusive process. You start looking at things that you value and you say, how do you make them enduring? And when you do that by bringing all the people involved with them on board. Since these are largely global, we need those global players on board. You know, one of the many horror stories of what happened in response to Katrina was that the Europeans actually wanted to give us stuff, and the State Department didn't know how to receive it. Actually, our Customs Service didn't know how to receive it. And we had never actually received help from anybody. We gave it. We never received it. And the mechanisms messed up the ability for people to give in compassion the U.S. And guess what? The best people on flood control systems are not here in the U.S. They're in the Netherlands. They know how to deal with that. The expertise for civil defense is in places like Switzerland and Israel and Japan. Every year they have a national earthquake drill. They have the earthquakes, which, of course, are a very serious threat for them here. They go through that process, and they work out the kinks. And it's actually a nation-building kind of experience. This is something that I guess I think Americans could see as an opportunity. We don't want you to be paranoid. We want people to be pessimistic because that's not a part of a national character. But preparing for things that are going to be potentially dangerous to us, the process of preparing for them is almost always reassuring. And it ultimately reminds us why we come together as communities in the first place, because there are problems and challenges we can't solve as individuals or as families. We need our neighbors. And when we deal with those issues, even as contingencies, we remind ourselves the value of neighbors. And we lose some of our partisanship and we start to see what we really are, which are we're all stuck in this place together and we can prosper if we work together.
That brings us to the conclusion of this conversation. Our guest today has been Homeland Security expert Stephen Flynn. Steve, thanks for visiting.
Thanks for having me.
What would you like for your final selection of music?
John Lennon's Imagine.
To our listeners, we're pleased you joined us. For WFIU, I'm Owen Johnson.
The program you have just heard was recorded in April of 2008. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.